I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello, I'm Scott Soschnick.
And I'm Evan Novy Williams, and this is the Get Off the Court sports business podcast, The Sportacast.
Was that like old man get off my lawn?
That's exactly.
Was that what you
is.
Were trying to? I'm not sure if you were trying
young
to do
kids
that or
get
not.
Off my court.
Yeah, I mean, I wish, Evan, I told you years ago when you and I were both working at Bloomberg and I was a columnist, just for fun, somebody stormed the court. It was like, I don't know, like they beat the number 9 team in the country or something. And I was like, there's got to be some rules. Like you have to train your columnist brain a little differently, because I just in conversation was like, there's got to be some rules about this. So I was like, you know what? Okay, there's a column. I'm going to write a whole bunch of rules. Here are the rules that would permit the storming of the court. And unfortunately, due to paywalls and this and that, whatever, I can't find it. I just can't find it. I would love to go back and reference it. But I know beating – oh, yeah. Like, if you were favored in the game, you are not – I know Duke is a name brand. But if your team was favored, which means Las Vegas thinks you should win the game, you are not allowed to storm the court. And that is exactly what happened here. A team that was favored to win, the expected outcome happened, and still – those Demon Deaconers stormed the court. I don't.
Yeah, the news here for folks who missed it, Duke star Kyle Filipowski was injured after their loss at Wake Forest this week. As you said, weekend, Wake Forest was favored to win the game. They did. Duke is ranked. Wake Forest is not. Call this an upset, depending on how you want to structure it. But this is the latest example in a slew of going back a long way players who have been hurt when, particularly in college basketball and college football, when fans rush onto the court or field after big wins. And
we just had the conversation with Caitlin Clark. I mean, this just happened where Caitlin Clark, the biggest star in men's or women's basketball, got run over or bumped into or whatever you want to say when they stormed the court.
I do think it's funny is not the right word. Ironic is not the right word either. But there's some sad commentary here that the most famous college basketball player in the country can get hurt doing this. And there's a little bit of an outcry, but nothing really happens. And I would be surprised at this point if something doesn't actually happen in the wake of a Duke men's basketball player getting hurt when the court gets stormed. And I don't know exactly what
that
is. Conferences have increased for both basketball and for football, have increased the fines that are assessed to teams when this happens. Who knows if it, can you even ban it given just how hard it is in a basketball court?
How would you stop that many
people?
It's really
difficult, right?
Basketball, how about this? We call populace and we say, well, the new design of college basketball facilities be pop-up moats.
Just a metal gate.
No. I want moats. I want moats with crocodiles. Like, let's go medieval on this. If we're going to do it, let's do it right. You know, spikes that come through the ground. Yeah, really. Let's go medieval if we're going to do it.
It's really hard. It is a part of the culture. It is, and I'll be honest, for me even, a part of, I think it's cool in some ways, right? Like, I think it is, if you can do it properly, I think it is a really cool part of college sports that you
of
just
course.
Don't see.
Had the Princeton
sports.
Lightweight men's football team won even a single game, especially on the road, there would have been a storming of the field. Let's be honest
fans.
About that.
We did
a whole bunch of all of. Well, there was one. Did you see the one where some little school won and like one guy was on the court like that? That was shown. So you would have been there. But it is a part of the game. Storming the court is part of the game. I get it. But now we say, can you stop it? Do you want to stop it? If you do, how do you do? How much does it cost? Is it effective? How can you? How do we want to proceed? And then how do we implement those changes?
One of the interesting things we've seen is particularly on the football side, but we may have seen this in basketball as well. Oftentimes when fans storm the court or just storm the field in football, goalposts get torn down, you get a fine from the conference. Schools have been crowdsourcing those fines. So they have asked fans in turn to pay for that.
Money's
that's
never
how
the
strong
answer.
But that just, I think to me shows the way that schools think about it. And also, how fans and sometimes think about it, right? Is that they a lot of people who storm the field then end up donating to the fund for Ole Miss or for Tennessee to pay the SEC fine or to get the new goalposts put in. The whole thing is going to need a kind of a redefining of the culture of storming the court. And I am not convinced that college sports leadership or college sports fans are in any way ready to have that conversation. And it will be fascinating, Scott, to see over the next few weeks or even days, is there a consensus on anything that is more stringent on what we have right now? How do you prevent this in the future? And then the second thing that I do think is important to mention here is widening this not just from college, but to the pros. The proximity of fans to basketball players. It is a wonder that we have only had a handful of really bad incidents in the past few decades, even in basketball courts about that relationship. And there's so much about that's bad. And NBA players have talked about it.
I get it, but this one seems simple to me. But if I may, because just the other day we had something where Kevin Durant was running out of the tunnel or something, and some fan yelled a certain word at him, and what did he do? He stopped, he turned around, and then he engaged in conversation. And I'm like, guys, all athletes, you must ignore the crowd. It's like, do not engage. Somebody throws something at you, there's a reason you have security and other things. I mean, literally, if somebody's on the court threatening you, I understand. Well, that's the question, you have to take, you may need to take matters into your own hands. I got it. But do not engage like that. It's somebody says, somebody this, somebody throws. Don't engage. You just can't win that.
Well, I'm making a distinction between obviously the verbal and physical, right? Because I think that the challenge I'm talking about is that like there is very little in an NBA game to stop someone who's sitting close to courtside from running on the field and interacting with a player, right? Yeah. And player in the course of natural gameplay, it's not uncommon for them to interact with fans physically, right? And that can get messy. There's basketball has this. One of the beauties of basketball is the proximity between fans and players and how close you can get to the action. It's unlike any other major sport. But the challenge to that is this exact thing. And again, this is going to continue to be an option, whether a problem, an obstacle, whether it's fans storming the court, whether it's individual people running on the court, whether it's players who end up in the stands. This is not going to fix itself. And it's a tough one to try to parse out because it's a part of the sport and it's a part of the culture.
I think it'll all change once college basketball players are declared employees and he gets workers' comp because he was hurt when somebody stormed the court.
Scott. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Then we've got to change yeah, things. Totally. Thank you. I'll bring the great stuff up at the end here when we're ready to move on. Speaking of ready to move on, Eben Novi Williams, nobody is ready to move on from the MLB uniform story.
God.
Which, yeah. Well, I'll praise you. I called you genius recently. I mean, I'm not going to say you were genius on this one, but I will say that I read your story on sort of the smartest take now. Just sort of, all right, let me scene set. Where are we? Why are we here? And how do all the parties bear some portion of the blame, responsibility, whatever? You just sort of gave me this really good scene set about stuff in uniforms. I didn't know that it dated back. I had no idea some things were utilized or tested this much or whatever it was. I was really interested to find out that the Players Association does not have final say on the uniforms, even though they are – it's an official licensed product. Because, you know, when the unions took back the group licensing rights, now if I'm a Fanatics or if I'm a Nike, I need to cut a check to the players' unions for the right to use the players and their likenesses. And I also need to cut a check to the leagues to use all the marks. So I still would have thought that the players would have had some sort of final okay over uniform. But we found out from Tony Clark when he told our colleague Barry Bloom, no, that's not the case. We don't. We don't. That's between like Nike and Major League Baseball. So I learned a lot from the piece. But I don't see a lot changing. Like a lot of the complaints seem like this is stuff that you should have known a while ago. You're saying the pants were the same. Nothing has changed. We've utilized this before. So why don't you tell me sort of separate fact from fiction for people who didn't read your story. Separate fact from fiction and take me throughout the interested parties here and sort of just where they all stand right now.
This is such a fascinating sports business story with a lot of layers, Scott. So I'll start kind of way back at the beginning. Nike got the deal, the on-field baseball deal back in 2018. It started on the field in 2020. These new uniforms have been in the works for all six of those years. From what I understand, from the minute Nike and Fanatics and Major League Baseball agreed to this three-way deal where Nike would design the uniforms, Fanatics would make them in the same factory that had been making baseball jerseys for at least a decade prior, Nike decided at some point we're going to redesign these uniforms. And it took a while. They didn't redesign them immediately. That contract started in 2020. They spent the first 4 years. It was supposed to be three, now four, giving essentially the same uniforms that players were getting, roughly the same uniforms players were getting for a while as they redesigned these. And then come now, they roll out the new ones. The major changes are the jersey top is lighter. It's more breathable. It's more stretchy. It's slimmer cut as well.
It's performance apparel.
It's slimmer cut, which led to, from what I understand, led to the smaller names and numbers on the back, which a lot of people, fans more than players, I think, have been objecting to. And then on the pants, they changed the way that they're sized. Baseball, everyone I've talked to claims that the pants are the same exact thickness and same exact material as in years past. Other people online, at least fans, are pointing out that they look more see-through. To me, Scott, the two things that jumped out to me in reporting a lot about this in the past week, one is that it's clear to me that nobody in the Fanatics, Nike, MLB world thinks there's a problem that needs dramatic fixing at this point.
Despite the public outroar, nobody thinks there's
a problem. Yes,
that's a problem.
It's been tested for 6 years. A lot of players have worn these jerseys and have commented on the jerseys and given feedback. Nike designed exactly the jersey it wanted to design. Fanatics made exactly the jersey that Nike wanted them to make, and Major League Baseball distributed to players exactly the uniform that they wanted to have designed and manufactured to give to players.
Sounds like everyone should be happy.
So I think a lot of people were really caught off guard by this. And one of the takeaways I have is I think it took way too long, and who knows who's to blame here, but it took too long to respond to this. It's been 2 weeks since baseball players first got their hands on these uniforms and started talking about it. Fans ran wild on social media, taking photos, making jokes, creating memes. It became a viral thing for far too long before baseball started actually talking about what had happened, what was changed, what wasn't. And as we say, there's that adage that the rumors go halfway around the world before the truth puts its boots on. I think in some ways, like that's kind of what happened here. I think the story ran away from people who could have maybe educated both players and fans a little bit faster about what actually had changed and what hadn't. And then the last thing I'll say, I know I'm talking for a while here, we touched on it last week in the show. I think that the Fanatics is getting a lot of the hate here. It seems like, I talked to baseball about this on the record on Friday, baseball feels very happy with the product that was delivered. They have no problem with what was manufactured by Fanatics. I think what Fanatics is running into here is a lot of fans who feel like the fan gear largely made by Fanatics in the past decade has gotten thinner material, maybe feels a little cheaper. They don't like the product that much. And the fact that they saw baseball players, professional athletes, grappling with some of the same problems that they feel like they've had for years suddenly created this fire online where the virality and the humor and the mocking of it.
So that in itself, is that not a problem for Fanatics? That this tinder lit so quickly?
Look, if you were an investor in Fanatics, yeah, I think one of your concerns certainly is the way that Fanatics gets treated online. And whether that is 10% deserved, 90% deserved, I think depending on where you are, you're going to have dramatically different feelings about that. But there is no question that whenever there is a uniform issue of some sort, whether it is Fanatics doing or not, the general fan public on social media, one, assumes it is Fanatics doing, and two, blames Fanatics for it. And yeah, that's a tough hurdle to be in. This is part of this is all monopolies, right? Have this that when you are the essentially the only person making widespread fan gear in the U.S., there's probably
any problem will be ascribed.
Any problem becomes ascribed to you. Yeah, but it's definitely a fascinating undercurrent to Fanatics' business is that the as they became the dominant maker, the largest seller of licensed sports. Sports apparel in the country and the world, yeah, there's a dislike from a large subset of fans that comes alongside that.
You and I like to say that every story is a sports business story. You just got to sort of figure out, like this was obvious when you're dealing with Fanatics and Nike and Major League Baseball. Obviously, this is a sports business story. But I love, let's go back a little bit. Can I rewind just a little bit further? Like this should have been Under Armour creating these uniforms, but they backed out of the deal, right? As they did with many college teams as well. They trimmed that marketing spend that allowed like Nike to come in and for all these changes to happen, for people to go crazy that, oh my God, there's going to be a swoosh on the pinstripes. Oh my God. Whatever. But my favorite part of this whole thing is that very subtly, you know, Under Armour puts out a post of baseball pants on Twitter that just said, you know, so just a picture of baseball pants said, we got you covered. Yeah. So here's the company that backs out of the deal that it, like sort of starts all this in motion. And now they're taking advantage of the fact that their competition is having a problem here. So every story is a sports business story. Every entity is looking to see how can we benefit from this? How do we chime in? Do we chime in? That UA took the chance to just kind of just put it out there. You know, wasn't in your face. Just, by the way, we got you covered with like looking like a thick baseball pants.
Yeah, I think that show perfectly highlights how much this got away from everybody, right? Under Armour's not taking pot shots at Nike on social media all the time. This just, the humor around this ran so rampant that Under Armour obviously felt comfortable given the background that you just mentioned, Scott, which maybe their social media director knows or doesn't know. But yeah, the fact that Under Armour is out there poking fun at Nike, saying we got you covered with our baseball pants, I think shows just how much everybody lost the narrative on these new baseball uniforms. It took too long to get responses together.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
I will tell you, when I take the focus group of one to the Dick's Sporting Goods every new baseball season, and you know, you go look at there, they do have Nike, but I will say the Under Armour baseball stuff is pretty ubiquitous. Like there, you know, it's right there in your face, going, "Hey, here's all the stuff you need. You need gray, you need white. What do you need? There's everything you need."
Yeah. So I mean, that's is the big question. What is the fallout here for the companies here? It's do fans want to buy these jerseys less, right? Which is going to hit Nike, MLB, and Fanatics because everybody shares in those economics, but primarily hits Fanatics. And then secondly, Nike's baseball product that's not licensed, but the stuff that kids are buying, that softball players and baseball players are buying, parents are buying for their children, is there somehow some lingering fallback on the headlines here for that product? And that is the bigger business implication. And it's way too early to know the answer to either of those questions right now.
The only thing the baseball fan in me really wants to see is some team please sign Bartolo Colon to the shortest contract you possibly could, squeeze him into a medium and let him run on the field and take some pitches. That's what I want.
Bartolo is still pitching. I could be wrong about that, but he's like the Yeromir Jagr of baseball. He's just like playing in like the Curaçao League or somewhere in South America. Huh? He's, I believe that at least as of last year, he was still a professional baseball player in some capacity.
Well, it sounds like to me, and here's going to be my good segue, and I'll let you take it and explain, but it sounds to me like, and you'll know where I'm going, somebody may be in the need for a rebrand.
Mm.
Not the easiest thing to do, you know, why do you rebrand? How do you rebrand? What does it cost? What are the risks? But we did see a professional sports team in the middle of a season, right? But also with a clear eye toward the future, rebranding the logo and all. There's a lot of study that goes into it. You tell me, thumbs up or thumbs down for the Clippers of Los Angeles. Formerly, by the way, and if you read our story from Jacob Feldman, Gillian Zucker says, the president of the team, says like many fans have no idea like why they were called the Clippers, or that they came from San Diego, or you know, they just have no idea of the maritime influence on the team.
Yeah, so for folks who have not seen them, the Clippers have rebranded logo-wise, and including a boat, including the Clipper ship on the logo now. Jacob's story, which you referenced there, Scott, I think did a really good job of talking about the kind of the holistic and artistic approach to rebrands, with a clear eye, as you said, towards the Intuit Dome, the $2+ billion arena that the Clippers are currently building, that is going to be, according to Steve Ballmer, the most tech savvy, advanced stadium arena in the world when it opens. Yeah, I think this is a fascinating look at not just uniform design and not just logo design, but also kind of I'm trying to think of the right word here. The Clippers have a reputation and a brand that I think Ballmer is trying to break from the history of the Clippers, right?
They're always like at least in LA, the Lakers are the platinum brand. I mean, it's always sort of that little brother, little sister
lovable
thing.
Loser type thing. Not just
they success. Haven't had a whole lot of success.
Yeah. So I think that I think it is smart to try to hit the reset button in as many ways as possible. If you are Steve Ballmer's and if you're the Clippers heading into a brand new a season in a brand new building with new uniforms and a new court logo and who knows what else they're going to do, but the Clippers have not had a ton of success on the court, and that comes with a laughable kind of reputation, I think, in some ways off of it, and everything you can do to try to rid the team of the old thing as you head into the new era, I think, is a smart maneuver. And we'll see how much it works.
I gotta think, like, Lob City was a thing for a while with the Clippers not long ago. I don't know, somehow some way my wife, don't ask me why, I think she liked when Darius Miles and Quentin Richardson did this on the court. Like, I'm not kidding you, she would be sitting at home or whatever, something good would happen and she'd do this. I'm like, what are you doing? She got a hat. We went to, I think at the time, I'm trying to think of what the arena must have been, Brendan Byrne or whatever, Izod Center, whatever it was. I remember she was talking with Darius Miles getting a hat signed. I mean, I'm like, really? Nobody else cared.
That's amazing.
But yeah, she was no pun intended. She was into it.
That's what I when I think Clippers success, that's definitely the Q and Darius Miles.
It's not
Miles,
Paul Silas in San Diego. Is that what you're telling me?
It is not. No, and it's not even the more recent success that they've had, right? With Kawhi and Paul George and Blake Griffin and of the past 10 years. It's definitely the Quentin Richardson era for me.
All right, but let's go back to sports business. Remember when David Stern and the NBA took control of the Hornets?
Yes.
Do you remember what David Stern did?
Rebranded.
No. Much more impactful.
I don't.
He wouldn't let a trade of Chris
Paul
go through.
Oh, that I do remember. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yes. So that, again, shaping franchises. Just, again, every story is sports business. You may think it's basketball, but why? Because they had to assume control of the franchise, which they later sold. So anyway, who else had success? That is college athletes with a recent ruling in the court. Mike McCann did a hell of a job. I say this is my new thing. Anytime there's a story where many outlets are covering it, and this is one that mainstream outlets cover, sports business outlets cover. Anytime you have one of those stories that everybody's writing about, it matters more than ever who you have sitting at the keyboard. And when we're talking NIL, I got to tell you, man, knowing that Mike McCann is piloting our ship, I'll go back to years ago when you'd say, what do you think of the story? I'm like, I don't know. I got to read McCann. Then I'll know what I think about it. And that is true to this minute. Like, he has an innate ability to make very complicated things easy to digest. So in essence, court ruled that there can be no restrictions on NIL. And more importantly, the one thing the NCAA could hang over, the sword of Damocles, so to speak, they could hang over heads of athletes, was that there could be retroactive punishment if and when this, this was reversed or whatever. And the court took care of that too. Said, no, there can be. So in essence, it is open season, right? You can do whatever you want. You can pay for play. Come to my school. I'll give you money. That is a big deal and probably the death knell of the side of all the of the amateurism that we've
heard. This
about.
Is a temporary injunction that was filed by a U.S. district judge in the legal fight between Tennessee and the NCAA. The NCAA tried to hand out punishment for or investigating Tennessee for NIL violations, and Tennessee responded very litigiously and very quickly. So this is not a formal final ruling at all, but it is a big step and just another kind of chink in the armor of the NCAA in terms of its business model and its holding on to amateurism. It is there is so many now antitrust lawsuits, this one included, but there's a number working their way through the courts. We have the Dartmouth basketball team looking for union status. The end game here is players employed by their university almost definitely in some capacity. The interesting thing or ironic thing about the NIL stuff is this ruling comes out last week. Suddenly the NCAA is barred from enforcing any of its third-party NIL rules. The truth, what changes in the aftermath here, I think, is nothing, because nobody was really respecting these rules in the first place. You know, I likened it on a call earlier today, Scott, that like this feels like if New York said that jaywalking was suddenly allowed. Like, would that change any New Yorker's approach to crossing the street? No, because nobody really thinks about that rule on the books as being enforceable anyway. So the idea that no one was being paid, no college athlete was being paid for as an inducement to attend a school because the NCAA did not allow it up until last week is laughable, right? It's fallacy.
But it takes a lot of gray matter to kind of fake it. Like, you know, now you don't even have to fake it.
But I think the end result is I think a lot of people who are doing this kind of thing already, negotiating deals like this and facilitating deals like this, don't suddenly feel like anything changes because they were already pushing the boundaries of those rules to begin with.
Right. Now they just take out ads and say, come here for X.
Exactly.
Big win for Neon Boudreau. All right, let's move on. Lionel Messi picking up where he left off. Scores levels a match late in the game. I love that. But big brands, by the way, Galaxy and Inter Miami. So Messi being Messi, but within the last few days. And this astounds me, even for popular people. I haven't looked. What does Taylor Swift have? I don't even know. I'll look. But Messi has 500 million Instagram followers, joining, of course, Cristiano Ronaldo at that mark. I'm going to go look at like what Taylor Swift is right
Taylor
now.
Taylor Swift is not in the top 10 because I'm looking at the top 10 right now.
But that, all right, so give me some of the others. And think about that. When you have a deal where, you know, the sign-ups, Apple sign-ups for the MLS subscription, you get a piece of that, and you can direct market to 500 million fervent followers, man, you know, I wish that – we got to get a line to Leo just says, oh, by the way, and sign up for Sportico. Mexico, that's good. You get your Apple. I want you to get your business out of the way. And then just an, oh, by the way, you know, if you're still reading and you have a moment, sign up for Sportico newsletters. Remind me, to-do list, put that to Lionel Messi.
The most followed people on Instagram, number one is Cristiano Ronaldo, 622 million people.
622.
Lionel Messi, number two at the 500 million that Scott mentioned.
So let me ask you this. Who are the 122 million people that are following Ronaldo that are not following
Messi? Well, I have an idea of that because I read Kurt's story on this. I'll give you my theory.
Let me hear it.
Lionel Messi's Instagram following is 72% male. I would bet that the 122 million people that are following Cristiano and not Leo may be a lot of women who view Cristiano as a sex symbol in a way that they do not view Lionel Messi. I was shocked by that number. 72% male for Messi, 85% under 34 years old. That doesn't really surprise me. Most countries with his biggest follower count, Brazil is number one, India number two, Argentina number three, and then United States number four. So those are some stats on Messi. To step back about the top 10, by the way, this shouldn't surprise me, but it's still shocking to look at. These are the only two athletes in the top 10 most followed celebrities on Instagram, unless you count The Rock as an athlete. He's number five. There are one, two, three, four Kardashians on this list. Kendall Jenner at 10, Khloe Kardashian at 9, Kim Kardashian at 7.
Can I tie
seven,
it all together,
Kylie
by the way?
Jenner
Kim Kim Kardashian tweeted, I think this morning or the other day, her son escorted Messi onto the field for the Galaxy game, right? Right? I think that that's what it was. And by the way, good time for me to promote. That's when my son escorted Didier Drogba when he played for Montreal. Anyway.
Yeah, 4 of the 10 most followed celebrities on Instagram are from the same family. That is it's an incredible.
That's well, that's why they built an incredible business,
right? The other names on this list, Beyonce at 8, Ariana Grande at 6, Selena Gomez at 3. So that is your top 10.
You could have given me all day and Sunday. I never would have come up with Ariana Grande being that high.
380 million. I mean, she's sandwiched between Kim Kardashian and Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
And where's Taylor Swift?
Not on the top 10.
That baffles. How can Ariana Grande be ahead of Taylor Swift? This is a sports business podcast, but I don't care. I'm going pop culture.
Part of this, I think, this is not our expertise. Part of this, I think, is how much you actually care about Instagram, right? The more you do on Instagram, the more followers you're likely going to have. Secondly, I wouldn't be surprised if outside of the United States, Ariana Grande is as popular as Taylor Swift is in places in Latin America, for example, or elsewhere around the world. This is obviously because there's no other non-soccer players here. This is obviously a global platform that reflects your global stardom and not your stardom in the United States.
I still would have thought Taylor Swift was bigger than Ariana Grande. Maybe she just doesn't value the platform. Our last question for you, and you can just say, I don't know, and I'll look it up and we'll bring it up next time. But what was the gender breakdown for Ronaldo?
Well, it's funny you say this, Scott. I asked this exact question to Kurt today. I don't know, but we're going to hopefully get the answer.
He didn't put that in
there? He didn't have it, I don't think.
Oh, come on.
But yeah.
I love Bodenhausen, but that's a fail.
If Messi's following is 72% male, I have to believe Cristiano's following is significantly more balanced on male to female. I could be wrong about that, but hopefully we'll have an answer to that question at some point soon in Sportico's pages.
Oh, I got to boost my numbers. What I'm going to do is pull up my shorts really, really high and flex my thighs. That's what I'm going to do. That's the classic Cristiano pose,
exactly.
Right? Maybe he's all Vaseline'd up. I don't know. And lastly, I love this story. Antelope Valley, NAIA school. In essence, the school was going belly up. They told the team, we have no money, we're shutting down, and you can't go to the postseason and forget it, we're not doing that. What do? You set up a GoFundMe, right? And they didn't get all the way there, but a company did come in to fill the gap, and Antelope Valley will indeed be participating in the basketball postseason. So if you're big fans of Antelope Valley, good for you, because you're going
to
see your team.
What a story, by the way. We don't have time to talk about the full thing, but NAIA school, so not part of the NCAA, but part of a lower division. School is going, they're ceasing operations, physical in-person operations in the middle of the year, and both their men's and women's basketball teams are in first place and already have berths in the NAIA season-ending tournament. So the coach's pay has been shifted to equity and the company that owns the university, and they crowdsource the travel, and the former founders of the university are now paying to keep the lights on in dorms, so the players are still housed. There's another company, Chegg, that is coming in to maybe also participate financially. There's a lot going on there, but a really fun little story coming out of Southern California.
Yeah, when I saw it, I was like, hey, let's write about this. This is kind of cool. Like, first of all, just Antelope Valley alone, I want to know more.
Hopefully we'll talk about that more on a future episode. You can find Scott. Scott does not have 500 million followers on Twitter, but if you would like to help him get there, you can find him at Soshnik. I also do not have 500 million, 500 million followers on Twitter.
How many does at Evan have? Hold on. You can keep going. I'm going to look up
but
at
you can
Evan.
Add to my total on yet Twitter to at Novi underscore Williams. The show is produced by Aaron Greenewald. Evan. Thank you very much to Aaron for everything
at
she
Evan
does. Cora Beltman, Sportico's digital media editor, would like you to know that you can follow the show at Sporticast.
Hold on. At Eben Official. 241,400.
At Eben, not me. Yeah.
This is at Eben Official. Good for you, Eben Official. Don't worry. Artist, producer, DJ. All right. There we go.
In the wrong industry. Sportico's digital media editor, Cora Beltman, would like you to know that you can follow the show at Sporticast, which is the hub of the Sportico Media Network.